From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. Science and technology that's interesting, fun, and if we can understand it, well, so will you. I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Our first guest this morning, Dr. Andrew Shapiro. He's the founder and chief technology officer of Proteus Space. It's a new spacecraft company. Now, Shapiro was previously the manager of technology formulation for the Space Technology Office at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where he was responsible for the early development of technologies for future missions. We really look forward to having Andrew back on the program.
Yes, we do. Our second guest this morning is Paula Kane. She's a technician in NASA's Thermal Blanket Lab, which is a vital part of ensuring that the important equipment that we send into space remains protected from getting either too hot or too cold. This is a really interesting story, and we look forward to talking with Paula.
Yeah, we certainly do. So these two guests, plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peak. Our next guest is Dr. Andrew Shapiro. He's the founder and chief technology officer of Proteus Space. It's a new spacecraft company. Now, Shapiro started a company developing very small spacecraft to do the jobs big spacecraft used to do. And his company is also going to tackle some new missions, important missions, such as space debris removal. Andrew Shapiro, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
John and Lynn, it's a pleasure to be back with you guys.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. And, you know, the last time we spoke, we were talking about a project that you were looking into that you put out for comment, and some people came back with some ideas on how to repurpose astronaut waste when on long missions, like to Mars. We all know that weight is at a premium when you are in outer space. How's that going?
So that's a great question, John. I've been working with a NASA-sponsored challenge. Now, NASA has been sponsoring several challenges, and today maybe we can talk about a couple of them. But one of the challenges that they had that they sent out to the public was what to do with astronaut waste. And this is a wide variety of waste, from the clothing that the astronauts wear to the packing materials that they use to keep their equipment safe during launch, to the human waste that they have to deal with. For shuttle missions and for station missions, they have particular ways of doing that. For instance, the clothing that the astronauts wear in the station, they wear for about a week, and then they bundle them up and they send them home, and I think they get incinerated. They actually don't use them again because it would take more water to wash them. It's not a good trade to bring the water up to wash clothes, it turns out. Now, this is fine for the station, but if they are going to the moon or going to Mars in particular, where the transit might take something like 9 months, this kind of strategy doesn't work. So NASA put out this challenge through a company called HeroX that managed the challenge, and they asked the public what kinds of things could you do with astronaut waste and with waste from the spacecraft itself. And they came up with amazing ideas. There were a huge number of entries, several hundred. They narrowed them down, and they picked about 20 winners of those concepts. And there's some really fun things in there. One of the ones that we looked at was being able to use the astronaut clothes, if they were cotton, to repurpose them and to make them into sheets to put seeds in that you could grow hydroponic plants. Other things we're looking at, packing materials. You know, think of the foam peanuts or something like that that you would use to keep something safe. And they would repurpose those and essentially, if you would, melt them together and then use them as feedstock for 3D printing. And for the 3D printing, they could print astronaut tools and other things that the astronauts might need in the cabin during the transit. So a lot of really interesting stuff going on there.
Well, that's just fascinating. I mean, it's probably too crazy to ask them to go naked for 9 months. So we need to figure out what to do with their clothing. But I'm just fascinated by this 3D printing piece, because we know that when you're out in space, if anything breaks down and you don't have the spare part, you're in trouble. So you're bringing a 3D printer or maybe two with you on a on a mission like that. And I had heard that they were talking about actually taking astronaut waste and mixing that possibly with polymers and things to make tools. Is that something they're also looking at still?
Yeah, certainly. That was among the suggestions that they had brought. So in the different entries, there were a number of sources that people had thought of for using in terms of printing materials and actual astronaut human waste was one of those things that they actually considered for repurposing in that fashion. The other thing they did is much also like the Martian, where they suggested using astronaut waste as fertilizer for growing plants.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Andrew Shapiro. He's the founder and chief technology officer of Proteus Space. What does Proteus mean?
That's a great question. Proteus is a Greek god, and that's one that we had used. Proteus is using a technology from another company, actually, a German company called Morpheus. And Proteus was created in order to be able to sell Morpheus products as well as some of the other developments in the new space industry to the U.S. government. Morpheus is a German-owned company and has some incredible technology in the direction of miniature thrusters. And Proteus is using that technology along with others that it's found from NASA and from other new space companies to give the U.S. government the opportunity to enable their missions for a much, much lower cost and in a different strategy than they have been using before. And maybe this is time to talk about the whole change in the space industry. I think right now we are at a huge tipping point in how the space industry works. I've been involved in the space industry for the last 40 years. My father worked in the aerospace industry when I was a kid. So I've been tracking it since early days. I used to listen to the Gemini communications on the radio. They actually broadcast them on AM radio when I was a kid. And we're at a completely different point, something totally new in the space industry. Up until now, spacecraft were made one at a time, maybe half a dozen. At the most, a large constellation of maybe 20 for communication satellites. But today, that has completely changed. We're now making these very small satellites in the thousands. And in the last year, I think last year, they launched about 2,000, 2,500 satellites, something like that. That's more than the entire humanity had launched until today. So we doubled the number of spacecraft ever made in the last year, and it's getting larger. We think that probably something I've seen estimates all the way from 20,000 to 100,000 satellites by the end of the decade. So things have changed completely. Now what that means is that spacecraft are now not individually crafted, but have moved to more of an assembly line process. Think about automobiles as a individual made automobile, and then what Henry Ford did with an assembly line. That kind of transition is happening in spacecraft today. And whereas just a couple of years ago, if I needed a particular radio, I had to have it custom ordered. I had to have a very specific idea of what it did in terms of the power and the frequency and exactly what this radio was supposed to do. Now I just say, I need a communications radio for my satellite. I've got 20 different vendors I can go to. I can just buy one and put it on my spacecraft. So it's a completely different situation with the space industry, and it opens up all kinds of possibilities.
Yeah, it's so interesting to hear. I mean, we hear on a daily basis about SpaceX and, Blue Origins, and those are big, you know, those are doing the big spacecraft, but the proliferation of these little aerospace industry companies to support, you know, on down to dealing with astronaut waste. I mean, what a concept. And how many little companies like that, this, like Proteus, are there out there doing jobs that most of us will never hear about?
Well, that's a great question. And actually, I have absolutely no idea. I can tell you.
So there are that many, huh?
I can tell you that there are hundreds. I've been to half a dozen small spacecraft conferences in the last year, and there are literally hundreds of vendors. I understand that there are probably over 100 launch vehicle vendors at this point. So think about that, over 100 people who want to make rockets to put these things into space. So there are just dozens and dozens of these small companies making, a lot of them are just making particular components like the thrusters or the radios for these.
I always look forward to this conversation with you, Andrew. We haven't spoken to you in a little more than a year, but it's always, I mean, you're always up to so many different interesting things. I wanted to go back to the mass production of larger numbers of CubeSats and spacecraft and those sorts of things. I spoke to someone that had a lot to do with tracking asteroids, and they were using some devices, some spacecraft that were outside our atmosphere, and they were able to determine, you know, where these asteroids were and that sort of thing. But they're starting to have problems when they are trying to observe them from the actual planet because of all the stuff that's up there, the man-made stuff, the debris, and the satellites. And a couple of weeks ago, Lynn and I spoke with a woman, a PhD candidate from Yale, who is trying to understand the 500 star systems in the atmospheres of the 4,000 exoplanets in these 500 star systems. And she said it's starting to become a problem. So my question is sort of twofold. Is one, what can we do about this to better manage all of these numbers going up? And secondarily, what are your thoughts on the political ramifications? We have a world that has trouble agreeing on anything. Would we be able to get worldwide support for such an endeavor?
Those are both excellent questions. So there are many, many more objects going into orbit every day, all those 2,000 a year or more spacecraft that we talked about. Most of them at this point don't have any kind of propulsion system, meaning that using these kind of CubeSat standards, and for your audience who's not familiar, CubeSat is 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters. This is a very small cube, just a few inches across. And those tiny satellites are essentially let loose in orbit, and there's no control of them. They don't have any ability to do anything but just stay in orbit because they don't have any kind of thrusting capability, any mobility capability. So a couple of things that we're doing, one of them, Proteus Space is able to supply thrusters that actually work for these spacecraft. The face of the Proteus thruster is about the size of a quarter, just to give you a scale. So now all of a sudden we're able to maneuver these very small spacecraft, which is a huge change. Another thing that's happened is that there's interest in removal of this debris, and Proteus Space is developing a spacecraft with a robotic arm supplied by my friends at Motive Space Systems, who built the robotic arms on Mars, to grab orbital debris. So I can take my small spacecraft with its small robotic arm, just all I need to do is hold on to the spacecraft. And then with the thrusters, I can bring it down to a lower orbit where it will decay. I can let go of the debris, and I can bring my spacecraft back up to the higher orbit and grab more debris. And then the lower orbit stuff will decay within weeks or days. And so there is some ability to actually start removing orbital debris. I know that the Department of Defense has taken a great interest in this, and that they had a huge call, a proposal call which a number of companies just got funded, called Orbital Prime, where they were actually looking at a large variety of companies with different strategies for removing some of this debris, among some of the other things. So there are strategies to start dealing with that. In terms of international agreements, though, this is a whole different problem. And I was at a conference in San Jose a few months ago, and they had a panel session on this topic, and they had some industry experts on the panel, and everybody agreed that this is a big problem. Everybody agreed that this is something that they need to work on. There are international companies that were very interested in working on this problem, but nobody is willing to take the first step in this. So we've got a ways to go. So everybody agrees that somebody needs to solve the problem, but nobody has stepped up yet.
Andrew, I know you're involved in so many fascinating things. You've got this new spacecraft company. You're consulting with a number of different vendors. There's so many things going on. And of course, there's some fascinating things that are going on at NASA. And you used to be responsible for all the sort of forward technology, looking at missions at 2030 and 2040, some of the stuff you were working on. Are you working with people at JPL who develop some of the most jaw-dropping technology on the planet? There's something about JPL. They're involved in so many fascinating things. Do you miss that? You had so much contact with so many people as you threw ideas out there and worked through the phase review process on some of these programs. Do you miss it?
It's a what can I say? It's a mixed feelings on that. I do miss it a little bit, but truthfully, I'm involved with those folks from day to day anyhow. Most of my friends at JPL I still talk to. Most of the suppliers that I worked with and the universities that I worked with when I was there, I still work with. And so my job in the new space industry overlaps tremendously with the kind of work that I did at JPL. I talk to JPL experts every week. I talk to NASA experts every week. And the difference is, I think, that it's actually easier for me to implement some of the changes that we think should happen in terms of things like orbital debris. NASA, by definition, needs to be cautious. It needs to be careful. It's spending the public's money, and it has accountability. And so it has to be really careful about how it spends that money, and has to document things and make sure that things are being taken care of in a fashion that everybody can agree to. I don't have to wait for those agreements. I can just go and take care of things when I see the opportunity, which gives me a little more freedom. So I'm enjoying my new role.
Andrew, I'm wondering how NASA vets all of these hundreds of small vendors. You know, as you were talking about, of course, NASA's using the public's money to do so. And they're, you know, NASA is in and of itself a bureaucracy. How do little private contractors get into, you know, doing business with NASA?
That's not a simple process. It's a challenge for NASA and for the vendors as well. It's going to be hard for NASA to take advantage a lot of these new technologies and these new companies. It does have a couple of venues, though, where it can do this. One of them is the SBIR program. So NASA manages its portion of the SBIR funds. I know other government branches have their own portion of the SBIR funds. But NASA is very methodical about how those SBIR funds are spent. They come up with particular topics and topic areas. They have groups of experts sort these topics out very carefully and request proposals in very specific areas. And then small companies are given the opportunity to propose to those. There's a cycle every year where companies can propose into these SBIR programs. They get reviewed by experts, and NASA does a tremendous job of vetting these. They have, you know, the availability of all these experts that can look at technologies that new companies are coming up with and select ones that are really appropriate for NASA to move forward with. And so they're very good at doing this and have a strong program. They usually have on the order of 100 SBIR contracts at any given time. I don't know the exact number, but it's a substantial number. And so that is one venue. I mean, the other venues are when NASA has a mission and there are very specific technologies that it needs, it talks to everybody in the world and says, who has that? A lot of technologies that NASA flies, particularly the cutting edge stuff, come from universities. And a lot of those university technologies end up being spun out of small companies. Mm-hmm. And so I've seen a number of small companies come out of the universities developing technology that NASA needs to perform its missions.
Mm. Okay, Andrew, you have to take me back into this, you know, mind's eye view of orbital debris. And when you were talking about the Proteus thruster being the size of a quarter on this very small spacecraft that could, with a robotic arm, go around and pluck this debris and bring it down to the Earth's atmosphere, I guess, to be able to decay on its own. It just leaves me with a lot of questions. Like, how, being so small, you know, how small is the debris that the robotic arm can go out and pluck? And what does it look like out there in the orbit in terms of debris?
So that's a great question. The orbital debris has a huge range, and most people don't understand how large a range of objects are out there. They're anything from things like stages of Apollo, right, which are you know, multi-story high giant objects, down to fragments. There are, I know in the last 20 years, both Russians and Chinese have had spacecraft that have exploded. And so they're little tiny fragments of spacecraft, and those fragments all just stay in orbit, right? They, even though the spacecraft explodes and they may spread, each little piece of the spacecraft has its own orbit. So there are thousands and thousands of these little tiny pieces of scrap. We still don't know at this point how small an object is reasonable. And we're more concerned, I think, with larger objects at this point. Most of these things are going in the same direction that you're going. So think of, you know, traffic on the freeway. It's moving very fast, but the car next to you, relative to your speed, is not that different in speed. So most of these things are kind of going along the same way that you are. We can, with a very small spacecraft, and because there's no atmosphere, we can grab substantially larger objects than our own spacecraft and bring those down. And when we get to a lower orbit, say on the order of 300 kilometers or 250 kilometers, those will burn up in the order of days or weeks. And so pretty much everything that we can bring down to a lower orbit will incinerate as it goes. It'll just vaporize as it enters the atmosphere.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Dr. Andrew Shapiro. He's the founder and chief technology officer of Proteus Space. It's a new spacecraft company. And this company is developing small spacecraft to do the big jobs that big spacecraft used to do. And they're also tackling new missions. We just spoke about debris removal. That is certainly an issue. And one of the other things is to have specific CubeSats, these small spacecraft, that would be able to measure the Earth's magnetic field. And before, I'm gonna ask you about that application, but before we talk specifically about your designs of, or what you're trying to accomplish with these small spacecraft measuring the magnetic field, I wanted to ask you, how much does the magnetic field vary over time? And would the magnetic poles ever swap like that occurs on the sun?
Yeah, so great question. The magnetic poles do swap, and scientists are concerned that the poles are going to swap relatively soon. But when I talk to the scientists about what does relatively soon mean. They talk in geological time. So it could be 20 years. It could be 500 years. So I have a hard time. But the magnetic pole does wander quite a bit, and it's been wandering more. It wanders a couple of degrees every year. And the way that you can see this is if you look at a map, and pilots who navigate the globe on their map, they have a compass offset of true north to magnetic north, and that compass offset changes every year. And what's happening with this government challenge, it involves NASA and NOAA and a couple of other government agencies. They previously have gathered that data from very large satellites. And what they've done this last couple of years is put out a challenge where they are making this measurement with CubeSats. They're 3U CubeSats, which means 30 centimeters by 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters. And these very small satellites are now going to make this magnetic measurement, and the challenge is to see whether the magnetic measurement that they make is sufficient to update the maps in something called the Worldwide Magnetic Model. So there's a global magnetic model that NOAA has, and they're going to gather the data to update this model so that we have accurate magnetic direction from wherever we are on the globe.
Proteus is part of Greek mythology. So is Artemis. Artemis was the twin sister of Zeus. Artemis's brother was Apollo, first man on the moon. And the Artemis program is the next man and the first woman to go to the moon. And we don't just want to go to the moon. We want to establish a base, a presence. We want to spend a lot more resources understanding the moon. Would this be a perfect application for CubeSats to be able to release those and have them play a role in communicating with the folks that are in the base on the moon base and also back with Earth?
Yes, I think the small spacecraft have a great role in that new Artemis scenario. NASA just put out its Moon to Mars objectives for public comment, and they show the overall objectives for bringing man to the moon using the Gateway, which is a space station that it'll be near the moon in orbit, and also their transit to Mars and Mars surface operations. So NASA has fairly large plans, and there are a lot of kind of little infrastructure things. For instance, things like telecommunications. Suppose you want to talk to somebody at some different location on the moon, because there will be multiple moon bases, I expect. How would you do that? Well, small communication satellite would be a great way to do that, and the CubeSats are certainly capable of doing that kind of thing. Likewise, if you want to talk to people on the far side of the moon, where you can do some really interesting astronomy and radio astronomy, again, your guest who was looking at exoplanets, that would be a great location for her to do observations, because then she's out of the debris field and out of the Earthshine, and she can get all kinds of great measurements. How would you do that, and how would you communicate that data back? And I think the CubeSats do definitely have a role there.
Dr. Andrew Shapiro, founder and chief technology officer of Proteus Space, a new spacecraft company. He's one of the driving forces of Space 2.0, this new way of operating. We want to thank you so much for joining us this morning, and we can't wait to have you back again.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, Andrew. Okay. Now, our next guest is Paula Kane, who took her love of sewing and fashion design and transformed that love into her career at NASA as a thermal blanket technician. Thermal blankets, or clothes for spacecraft, help spacecrafts function in the extreme environment of space. NASA's thermal blanket lab is a vital part of ensuring that the important equipment that NASA sends into space remains protected from getting too hot or too cold. Paula Kane, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, it's so great to have you. And I just think that, first of all, your story about being a fashion designer turned this kind of techie person at NASA is a fascinating one. So why don't you start with how you ever got there?
Well, I have a degree in fashion design. And before I came here, I worked at home and I had a design business. And I also have a degree in cosmetology or cosmetologist license. And to keep up on what was needed in the fashion design field, I would always check the classified ads. And one day I was looking in the classified ads under fashion design and it said, "Are you a, do you like Star Trek? Do you like to you like space?" And it says, "If you do, you may like a job as a thermal blanket technician." Well, I didn't know what it was. So I said, "Let me call." And I went on the interview and I found out that it would be working here. And I did the interview and actually got the job.
That's so great. So you used to design things like purses.
Purses, wedding gowns, accessories, clothes, you name it.
And then I just think it's so interesting that you love, you were a Trekkie. And this this love, this being a Trekkie really, I bet not many Trekkies could say that their love of Star Trek brought them into their career. But it
That's
did for
you. That's very true. That's very true, because most of the people that you meet here have a, you know, a science background. They're rocket scientists, they're, you know, mechanical, that type of thing. And to think from fashion design that I could put fashion design in Star Trek and end up working at Goddard, you know, at NASA, is just still amazing to me.
Well, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Paula Kane. She's a thermal blanket technician, or clothes for spacecraft, and she works for NASA. Well, they have quite a training program at NASA, don't they? I understand your first day at work, they threw you right into working on Hubble, my favorite spacecraft. So tell me about that. I mean, talk about putting your feet to the fire.
Yeah, that was kind of amazing and scary at the same time. When I started, they were doing servicing mission number 4. And they had just brought back everything, and we had to go through the blankets, repair blankets, match them up. We had, sometimes what we do, if it's a large structure, large spacecraft, you have like a map, a guide. So you had to match the numbers and put it back in its proper place. And they gave me everything, and they said, "Here you go. There you can do it." And I had to work it out and figure out where everything went, run wires, because everything has to be grounded so it's conductive, that type of thing. So it was exciting and scary at the same time.
And what has most surprised you over the years as you've worked to clothe a spacecraft from these extreme elements? There must have been some surprise along the way, or many surprises maybe.
Yeah, many surprises. And then, well, one of the main things that I'm still surprised about is, as long as I've worked here, that it's still new and fresh every day. There's always something different. One thing that's interesting, I never realized how much safety comes into play being here. I probably had been here maybe 2 weeks at the most. And if you go into a chamber, you have to put up a monitor just to make sure the levels are right, there's enough oxygen. And we had went in to take some blankets out of a chamber and the monitor's going off, telling us to get out because there wasn't enough oxygen. So that was scary. My second week, they're like, "Get out now." And I was like, "Oh my gosh, oh no."
This is serious stuff.
Yeah. So that always surprises me.
That's great.
But just such the variety, and then how many different people work here. It's a very diverse group of people that work here.
Well, I wanted to ask you about the story of Hidden Figures, which I assume you're probably familiar with. When Lee Shetterly first wrote the book, we interviewed her before it became the movie, which was a fantastic movie. It was about the African-American mathematicians that worked for NASA during the space race. And when I saw your story, it reminded me of very much the same thing. How, you know, and we hope that young women everywhere and young Black women really use these stories as an inspiration to go to work for a traditionally white male-dominated world or organization like NASA. So talk a little bit about that kind of influence.
Yes, that when I, before then, before the book, and I did not know about these women, and it was enlightening to me, and it makes you feel proud, and it helps us, because when you women, whether what color, to say that you work in NASA and what you do, they realize that, you know, basically anyone can work at NASA. You know, it's not just the person who has the math degree or science degree. It just opens up doors, and it makes you proud to know that, you know, you have a little bit to do with it by working here.
Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about materials. Mm-hmm. I guess I don't even really know what Mylar is or some of these materials that you're working with on a regular basis.
Yes. Well, a good example would be if you've seen any space movie and they show the International Space Station, you'll sometimes see it's sort of like a gold, brown, and copper color. That's Kapton. And all of our films there, they have a purpose. So usually if it's Kapton, it's going to try to keep things cooler. If it's silver, it's trying to keep it warm to help keep the temperature regulated. And certain things are put there because of their color, because especially on the International Space Station, we used beta cloth, which is white. They don't want things that are going to reflect back and like blind the astronauts while they're out there. So usually we'll use the beta cloth. So it's the thermal properties, and then what other, where it's going, how far up it's going to help regulate the temperature. But usually what happens is our thermal engineer will dictate to us what materials we would use depending on where it's going and what its purpose is going to be for.
It seems like they used to use foil quite a bit, and we saw that in the Apollo program with the lunar landing module, and we also have seen that with a number of other devices that are out surrounding the planet. So they are trying to move away from the reflective foil, or maybe have foil, but have it covered with this particular cloth.
Yes.
Is that
yes,
what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah. In some cases, they're doing that. Yes.
You know, Paula, some exploratory missions, we really don't understand what the range of conditions will be when we get there. And what I'm thinking about is Cassini, that was the spacecraft that was around the Saturn system for 20 plus years, and at some point dropped a probe into Enceladus, one of the moons off of Saturn. And there were these icy water particles that were being projected through from this geyser at 800 miles per hour. And yet this device was able to make accurate measurement of mm-hmm. what was coming out of this geyser. It was sort of a sniffer is what they called it. It grabbed the particles and actually analyzed them. But that was kind of a surprise to the technicians. They didn't know that it would be as hostile an environment as it was. So mm-hmm. how do you do this? Do you try to prepare for a worse case, or you just get the specs from the scientists, or, you know, how does that all come together?
Usually what will happen is they will run tests and do analysis before we get into it. And then whatever their analysis says, that's what they will tell us to use as film. And a lot of times what will happen is we'll use non-flight materials. So what I mean by non-flight is materials are certified for a certain amount of time. And then once it's out of that time, when it's out of cert, it becomes non-flight. And we may make a whole set of these blankets so they can test it and push it to its limits to know if that's going to work before we invest in the flight materials and make the flight blankets. And so the blankets are, you know, they're layers of film, and the amount of layers depends on what your scientist or your thermal engineer tells you.
Okay.
So how much have you learned about material engineering on the job? I mean, is it now?
All of it.
Yeah. All of it on the job.
I mean, I've learned, I don't know everything, but you learn. When I came here, I did not know any of this. I knew a little bit about Mylar from camping. You know, it's the same film. It's just the weight of it. We just use a different weight. The silver, you know, that keeps you warm, that you can wrap up with when you go camping. That's about all I knew. And then it's basically on the job training.
Yeah, that's so great. Well, you talked about Kapton. Is that what
yes.
it's called? And the
yes.
thermal properties of Kapton and mm-hmm. using that material in the thermal blankets. And I'm picturing you over at NASA, you know, designing a pattern for these blankets, and that must be very, very precise. And then actually sewing this material, what kind of machines are sewing these things?
Yeah. Well, nowadays we use more tape. Occasionally we will sew, but it's mainly for sewing on Velcro, or if it has beta cloth on it, we will sew it. But what happens now usually is whatever your outer layer is going to be, whatever substrate that is, that's the kind of tape you will use. One interesting fact is before I came here, I didn't realize you could make your own tape. So a lot of times now we will make our own tape, which is an interesting thing to learn, that you can just make your tape out of this film. And that's usually what we do. But as far as sewing machines, we do have some nice large industrial sewing machines for if we do need to sew anything.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Paula Kane. She's a thermal blanket technician for NASA. And the thermal blanket lab is really important because they before we send stuff into space, we need to protect it from being too hot or too cold. So Paula, some days you're fabricating, some days you're working on Hubble, some days you're up on scaffolding, and some days you're running very quickly to get out of a room because it's running out of oxygen. It's something new every day, huh?
Yes, that's what I love. It is something new every day. I'm a person who does not like repetitive things. An example would be when I was making wedding gowns, you know, you have a big wedding and there's 7 bridesmaids dresses. To do the same dress 7 times is just not my thing. So this is really good for me because it's a variety every day.
Yeah, exactly. And you are at Goddard Space Flight?
Yes, I am.
The thing about Goddard that amazes me is we've spoken to so many people from so many different organizations at Goddard, and all of them have so much enthusiasm for what they do. I can only imagine when you go into the lunch hall and all these people are talking about the things that they're doing. I mean, it has to be a rich environment to be a part of. It's not like being an accountant and an accountant firm. I mean, how boring is that? Or trying to keep bridezillas happy and things like that. I mean, you're talking to some fascinating people on a daily basis.
That is very true. Because though you're working on a particular project, you might run into someone and they're saying, I'm doing this and it's going to this place. And we have to figure out how we're going to make it stay cooler in a hot temperature or something like that. It's just interesting that here you don't have a lot of labels in the sense of someone will say, oh, I'm not going to talk to you about it because you may not know. They talk to you because you may know because of what your past experience. So it's a good it's good because someone will say, well, what did you do on a past project? Ours is very similar, but it's a little bit different. We might learn something from what you know. So it's really good. It's really enriching.
Well, it must be a work environment that is somewhat dictated by the person at the top, the NASA administrator. And we've had the good fortune to talk to Bill Nelson, I don't know, 1 or 2 times. We just love that guy. Is that where it comes from? Or is there just this culture, company culture that exists because the work you do and your mission is just so fantastic?
I think it comes from the people that are here because it's, ultimately, you have to be creative. And I think when you get creative people together, they just work well together. You know, you try to work things out. There's always going to be a little bit problems, but I think it's the people that work here. And then your administration, if they are helpful, it does help, you know, if they're supportive.
Yeah.
So I just think it's the caliber of people and the things you do. You can't work here and have a big ego because it doesn't work. You wouldn't get anything accomplished because each hand works with everyone. You have different departments and we all work together because one thing has to go on before the next. So it's not like you can go rush ahead and do your part. You have to communicate with the person who does their thing first.
Mm. You know, John, I mean, we've got this great part-time gig at KPCW doing Cool Science Radio, but, you know, we probably have time to have another part-time gig at NASA. What do you think?
I think we should be a part of Space 2.0 somehow. I think that we might be able to add some value. I don't know what value that would be other than, you know, we're kind of cheerleaders, Lynn, you know?
I'm sure NASA needs cheerleaders. Well, before we let you go, Paula, I just wanted to ask you, and I think it's so important about how you talk to other young people about, you know, finding what they love to do and how to go into that world. What do you do in that realm?
Well, when I get any opportunity, I will speak because I know I'm not the norm. So I've done a couple of things speaking to young ladies, Girl Scouts and schools that have come here. And they're always excited to know that I have a degree in fashion design. I just you know, whatever your interest is, don't limit yourself, because there's probably a place for you here if you want to be here, you know, because the sky's the limit, especially in the times we're living in now. There's no limitations.
Yeah, what a beautiful thing. Well, Paula Kane, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. I guess what do you call yourself? You're a thermal blanket technician, and you work in which department?
I work for Thermal Blankets.
Oh,
yeah, we're the thermal support group. That's what we call ourselves, TSS.
Oh, wonderful! What is your next project?
Right now, I am working on 2 or 3 different projects: OSAM, OCI, doing a little bit on PACE, RST. I'm forgetting something. There's quite a few. With us in the Blank Lab, we will help each other out. So you're basically on a lot of different things, and then a smaller project may come through the door. So you just do whatever they need for that day.
Okay. Well, Paula, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, Paula.
Thank you. Thank you.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peak. Lynn, how many times have you sent a text and said, oops, I really shouldn't have sent that? Or, boy, that thing got screwed up with the, you know, with the voice recognition. I need, you know, this is saying something completely different. And you said, man, I want to take that thing back. Has that happened to you?
Oh, I think it's happened to everyone. And the interesting thing is I always fault myself, of course. Like, why didn't I just take the time to read that over before I sent it? Because you can't unsend it. Until maybe you can.
Well, at the Apple Developers Conference this week, they announced a bunch of new MacBooks and a new operating environment for the watch and a this and a that. But they also talked about iOS 16, which is going to be the new release for iPhones. And it's going to include a long-awaited feature that allows you to edit and unsend messages that you've sent to someone. But as it turns out, there's a time limitation. You can edit or unsend a message up to 15 minutes after it's been sent. But not only do you have to have iOS 16, but the person you sent the message to has to have that rev as well.
Well, what I wonder about this, John, is whether or not you, I mean, it's a moot point if you send it and your receiver immediately reads it. It's too late. You can't edit then. Is that included in this function? I think it's hilarious that they've actually gone through the development, put, you know, all of these hours into developing this just to help us with our mistakes.
Yeah, well, and it's not just, you know, pick up some eggs on the way back from work. It's, I don't want to see you anymore. This is a breakup text. You need to think that stuff through, I guess. I don't know.
I think it would be really interesting to look at the whole plethora of breakup texts. But this is a thing, you know, it's a phenomenon, breakup texts, which is so bizarre.
Yeah, it's a crazy world. And you know something, Lynn? Also, there's a new option in iOS 16 that you can recover recently deleted messages, and deleted messages can be recovered for up to 30 days after deleting them. So let's say someone sends you special directions or a recipe or something, and somehow you inadvertently delete it, you can get it back up to 30 days with iOS 16.
Well, this whole world still makes me want to make sure I read over my texts before I send them again. How about you?
Yeah, me too. So, Lynn, this morning we're talking to Andrew Shapiro, who is so involved in driving this space 2.0, and he's a fascinating person. And then speaking with Paula, that's doing has such an important job, a cool job within NASA with the space blankets, the clothing that goes into protecting our spacecraft. So these are it's just an interesting organization, all the different moving pieces that they have to make these missions successful.
Well. Yes. And then I have to applaud NASA for opening up to all these, you know, that we were talking about, the hundreds of private vendors and companies that are now selling their spacecrafts to NASA. It's an evolution of an organization that's really positive and creative and flexible and adaptable, which is sort of how we all need to be, right? So
yeah.
Good stuff.
Yeah, it certainly is.
Thanks to our listeners. And as always here on Cool Science Radio, we love to get your ideas. We've got a lot of interesting experts right here in our own community in Park City and Summit County, and love to get your story ideas. It's coolscienceradio@kpcw.org. And of course, as always, if you want to hear our archive shows, you can go to kpcw.org under the Shows tab and Cool Science Radio. Also, anywhere you get your podcasts, please look us up. It's KPCW Cool Science Radio. Just like all of our public affairs shows are listed wherever you get your podcasts.